Welcome to the 2024 Volume 5, Issue 2, Winter Podcast Edition, Part 2, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published February 28, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For figures, citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Part 1. Table of Contents. Gerrans, Philip. 2024. Representation and Regulation in Emotional Theory. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 5, number 236-43. https://doi.org/10334972024. Winter.5. Whiting, Elizabeth L. 2024. Is Trusting Your Gut a Good Idea? Implications from the Emotional Mind. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 5, number 2, 44-51. https://doi.org/10334972024. Winter.6. Cochran, Tom. 2024. Replies to Hatzimoisis, Sievers and Hufendieck, Majid, Gerrans and Whiting. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 5, number 2, 52-61. https://doi.org/10334972024. Winter.7.
Article 5, Representation and Regulation in Emotional Theory, by Philip Gerrans. Like Cochran, I endorse what we can call an approach to the mind/brain that treats it as fundamentally a device of regulation rather than representation. The two approaches are not incompatible. After all, regulation requires representation, but they do have different emphases. In general, regulatory approaches focus on mechanisms that regulate adaptive behavior. Pizzullo et al. 2015, Seth and Friston 2016, Huebner and Shulkin 2022. On such views, representation emerges to enable regulation. Representational theories start with representational content of a system and treat mechanisms as implementation of a representational/computational system. The regulative approach fits well with what has recently been called active inference approaches to mind, and my aim here is to finesse some of Cochran's ideas using that framework. One advantage is that the active inference framework fills out Cochran's ambition to give a detailed mechanistic account of the generation of effect, Cochran 2018. Page 42. Another thing I agree with is that the best way to think of emotional experience is as taking us beyond immediate impact upon our bodies and representing the subject's own agent of powers. Emotional bodily feelings constitute a basic form of self-consciousness. 2018, page 111. This is part of his theory of the dual intentionality of emotional experience. It informs us about the state of the body and the relevance of the eliciting object or situation to our concerns. This conception is shared by somatic and cognitivist appraisal theories, but creates a different explanatory problem for each, Sander et al. 2005. As Cochran says, the bodily feelings we have when undergo emotions are not simply patterns of bodily sensations, 2018, page 89. So, a somatic theorist needs to explain how a bodily experience can represent emotional content that is the relevance of something to our concerns. As Cochran says, without some conceptual framework to deliver representational meaning, bodily feelings only present a certain degree of arousal in themselves, 2018, page 108. Cognitivist theories face the inverse version of the problem. On those theories, the emotion of fear, for example, implicitly or explicitly represents a danger to me, the formal object of emotion as it is known. But why should such a representation be felt as a bodily sensation? In general, there is no intrinsic connection between applying a concept and a distinctive phenomenology, Pace-Goldie 2002, Scherer 2004. Cochran's solution is that emotional experiences have dual intentional content. They represent the body and conceptual aspects of emotion, its relevance to the subject along dimensions familiar to conceptual act and appraisal theorists. Interestingly, although Cochran is a regulatory theorist of emotion, he deals with this problem as it is posed in the representational framework, and the structure of his solution reflects this. He says, quote, X is an emotional bodily feeling when, one, the individual conceptualizes, implicitly or explicitly, bodily feelings as emotional, and two, the individual is in a bodily condition that matches the typical condition of their body when undergoing emotion about a particular situation. End quote. 2018, page 107. This explanation requires that the relevant bodily state be conceptualized as emotional, an approach which is very close to the conceptual act view of emotions that treats them as bodily experiences interpreted or conceptualized in emotional terms. He explains conceptualization as follows. Quote, our feelings tell us something about our current state of self, as solid and secure or weak and contingent, enduring or transient. Although this content is represented intuitively by means of a non-literal sense of one's bodily condition in relation to an emotional space, the status represented can be entirely warranted. It is to be analyzed as an awareness of the disposition of the body towards interacting with the environment in a certain way. End quote. Page 114. So far, we have a detailed conceptual analysis that does justice to the phenomenology of affective experience as I being grounded in the body, 2. Informing us about the subjective relevance of elicitors, and 3. Being a form of self-awareness. As stated, this account lies more at the conceptual end of a continuum of mechanism schemata that abstract away to a greater or lesser extent from the gory details. To quote Gualtiero Piccinini and Carl Craver, paraphrasing Philip Kitcher, Piccinini and Craver 2011, at one end we have useful phenomenal models and mechanism sketches, and at the other, complete descriptions of mechanisms. These provide the gory details that, as Piccinini and Craver say, are fully explanatory. Clearly, Cochrane's aim is not just a mechanism sketch in Craver's terms, but a mechanistic explanation. This is why he discusses a condition known as pain asymbolia, to support the idea that affective experience is not reducible to sensory experience. It provides empirical support for a model/sketch that distinguishes sensory and affective components of experience. However, the account on which he relies, that of Nicola Gracq, 2007, does not do justice to the phenomenology of pain, suffering, and asymbolia or its mechanistic bases. The active inference account, by contrast, explains the complex phenomenology of pain, suffering, and self-awareness in a range of conditions in mechanistic terms. Von Moore and Photopulla, 2018. Jerrins, 2020. Kiverstein et al., 2022. In that respect, it helps realize Cochrane's ambition for a detailed mechanistic account. The more detailed picture does suggest that one ambition of Cochrane's theory cannot be met. That ambition is to preserve the idea that emotions are natural psychological kinds. A control or regulatory theory that focuses on mechanisms should abandon this ambition. The natural kind view of emotion comports better with a representational view of psychological processes. When, for example, we look at perception in primates, there is a clear decomposition from the computational level description via representation and algorithm to implementation in a perceptual system. There are some specialized mechanisms that perform the representational task of vision, initially defined independently of its mechanistic substrate. This is true on any theory of vision, Marian, inactive, inferential, and hierarchical predictive processing. However, there is no clear analogy with emotional experience. When we try and explain how it is that bodily experiences can do double duty as carrying information about bodily states and a formal object of emotion, we do not find anything analogous to a visual system. There is no specialized system whose role is to transform feelings of bodily arousal to feelings of danger. This does not mean that emotional episodes cannot be the object of scientific investigation, just that that investigation does not disclose the operations of a specialized emotional processing system that meets the criteria for being natural kind. So, to sum up, the regulatory/control approach is more radical than Cochrane suggests. One way to see this is via his discussion of pain asymbolia, a condition in which the subject is aware of sensory aspect of pain, nociceptive pathways are intact, but reports that the pain does not matter, is not painful, or in some cases, feels like it is happening to someone else. For example, quote, when a part of my body hurts, I feel so detached from the pain that it feels as if it were somebody else's pain. End quote. Sierra 2009. This rare condition is associated with damage to the posterior insular cortex, which is a convergence zone for interoceptive and basic bodily signaling. It is important to the understanding of the condition that the subject is aware of actual or potential injury, but does not feel it to be distressing, and is not motivated to avoid the painful stimulus. So, a key issue to be explained is why and how damage to the posterior insula causes a phenomenology of pain without suffering. The condition is thus a test case for theories about the relationship between bodily experience, which is intact in pain asymbolia, PA, and the emotional experience of suffering. A standard view in the early literature was that PA is evidence that pain has sensory and emotional/affective components that can dissociate. The dissociation is then explained in terms of distinct neural processing systems. This invites the idea that the experience of pain has a sensory motor and an emotional/affective aspect, with the latter being provided by an emotional processing system. This comports well with Cochrane's characterization of the relationship between sensory processing and affective experience. Alongside the sensory qualities of an experience, we should recognize a distinct affective aspect that is directly responsible for the intrinsically pleasant or unpleasant aspects of the experience. 2018, page 42 to 43. And Cochrane uses pain asymbolia as a case to distinguish unpleasant effect from the sensory components of pain, page 45. So, on a straightforward interpretation of pain asymbolia, it is a case of pain sensation without effect. This suggests that the affective aspect of an experience is something that is added by a discrete system that interprets and enriches the bodily signal, allowing it emotional significance as well as sensory information to be felt. Philosophers such as Nicola Gracq, who endorsed this conception, can point to classic neuroscientific studies of pain processing that posit a modular architecture with sensory motor and affective components. This idea localizes the sensorimotor aspect of pain experience to the integration of nociceptive signals in the posterior insula, PI, and the affective aspect of pain to a network whose hub is an anterior insula-anterior cingulate circuit, AICC. The idea that the affective aspect of a pain experience is based in activity in this AICC circuit was part of the first wave of pain theorizing, Danziger 2006, Klein 2015. As a theory of pain asymbolia, this faces two problems. The first is that asymbolia is a product of damage to posterior insula, not anterior, the hypothesis basis of suffering. This is not a decisive problem, because inactivity in PI will compromise activity in the AI at afferents, and that could explain the lack of effect. However, even if pain asymbolia is associated with lack of effect, it is not that lack that explains a lack of aversive response. Patients with frontal lobotomy have absent or reduced effect, but exaggerated aversive response to noxious stimuli. It is also interesting that Roger, a patient with widespread insulin limbic damage, has exaggerated aversive responses to painful stimuli, Philippi et al. 2012, Feinstein et al. 2015. Does this matter to Cochrane's account? It does not undermine it decisively, but it suggests that it does not yet provide a satisfactory account of underlying mechanisms, and that account posits a modular architecture for pain processing. In fact, another aspect of Cochrane's account can come to the rescue here, and that is the idea that affective feelings are a form of self-awareness that locates the subject in a space of possibilities for regulatory action. To show how this explains pain asymbolia and affect in general, we have to treat pain processing as a species of active inference implemented in essentially amodal circuitry. So, the control/regulatory ambition is supported, but the idea that emotions are natural kinds is not. In general, the science of pain processing has moved away from a modular conception with dissociable sensory and affective components to the idea that pain is processed by a distributed matrix of interconnected circuits, Melzack 1990. Betty and Agliotti 2016. The other salient feature of the matrix conception is that outside initial nociceptive processing, there is no circuitry specialized for pain. Pain experience involves a coordinated suite of neuroendocrine, immune/inflammatory, and autonomic responses mobilized by the brain to respond to a threat to bodily integrity. It also involves sensory motor and cognitive processes that are not intrinsically specialized for pain. It turns out that pain processing is not really a case of activity in a specialized system with modular architecture, but a coordination by the mind of a suite of essentially amodal resources to respond to nociceptive signals. What we see in an episode of Pain is a characteristic pattern of activity across a distributed matrix, most of whose elements are not specialized for nociceptive processing, Bushnell et al. 2013. Corns 2014, Betty and Agliotti 2016. Corns 2018. This is consistent with the active inference conception of the mind, which treats cognition as the mobilization of the mind's resources to enable adaptive action. Such actions include internal regulatory activity, as well as overt action. Of course, regulation takes many forms. Cytokine cascade, inflammatory response, appraisal, using cognitive systems that are not specialized for emotion, attention, memory, and executive functioning. The result of this coordinated activity is the effective feeling that signals success or failure of regulatory activity, Velasco and Loew 2021. In the case of pain, it signals suffering or its reduction. Recall that for Cochrane, effective feeling tells the subject whether to act to increase or reduce a form of experience by focusing attention adaptively. Within active inference, representation arises as an aspect of regulation. Crucial to this conception is the idea that in order to anchor and integrate activity, the mind represents systemic functioning as the activity of a unified entity, the source and target of regulation. The result of this integrated process is the feeling of basic bodily self-awareness, one of whose primary substrates is activity in the posterior insula, Fred et al. 2014, Moietti 2014. This integrative role for the PI is the reason why the nociceptive signal is felt to belong to me qua something I need to regulate. However, as a variety of conditions show, activity in the posterior insula is not sufficient to produce effective experience. That requires the integration of bodily self-representation with information that enables adaptive response that is mediated according to the subjective relevance of the eliciting situation. AI is a crucial integrative hub or relay station between bodily self-representation, whose hub is a PI, and the other systems whose coordination is necessary to determine and monitor adaptive response. It thus anchors activity across the mind, ensuring that it optimizes organismic function at all levels from basic bodily regulation to explicit social and personal level cognition. In virtue of this integrative regulatory function, activity in the AI allows bodily experience to be felt effectively. This also explains the functional promiscuity of the AI, involved in almost every self-referential form of processing, and the fact that it is not intrinsically specialized for anything. Rather, it is an integrative hub for the adaptive coordination of basic bodily and higher order processing. In virtue of playing that role, it sustains effective experience understood as a basic form of self-consciousness, Cochrane 2018, page 111, because as Cochrane says, at every level of representational sophistication, effect will evaluate the success or failure of our concern regulating projects, 2018, page 65. The key point is that project are felt as ours, giving rise to a sense of basic bodily awareness and the sense of self as a subject of effective experience. The relationship between bodily awareness, effect, and self-awareness is explained by the coordinating role of the AI. It ensures that regulatory activity is taken to optimize the functioning of the entity whose subsystemic functioning it represents as aspects of a unified self, Craig 2009, Eckert et al. 2009, Caught et al. 2011, Terasawa et al. 2012. This is why, as Klein says, asymboly is best explained, not as loss of effect per se, but as a change in self-awareness. The nociceptive signal is not modeled as belonging to the subject, qua target of regulation due to damage to the PI. As a result, the signal is not felt to require an adaptive response and does not initiate the cascade of higher order signaling coordinated by the AI. The system is not trying to regulate the nociceptive signal using effective experience as an index of success or failure. Asymbolia arises not because the subject has lost effective response to pain, although she has, but because she does not feel as though the pain is hers because the sensory signal is not processed as one that matters to her concerns. They recognize it as pain, but in some important sense it has ceased to be something worth caring about. It thus has the feel of a sensation which they can no longer identify with as their own, Klein 2015. As I say, I don't think any of this undermines Cochrane's account of effect or pain asymbolia since, despite the reductive ambition, they are pitched at a level of mechanism sketch, not the level of explanation. The gory details, in fact, reinforce Alada's account. At the same time, since those mechanisms are largely amodal and not specialized for emotional processing, the regulatory approach should lead to abandonment of the idea that emotions are natural kinds.
Article 6. Is trusting your gut a good idea? Implications from the emotional mind. By Elizabeth L. Whiting. Trust your gut. Perhaps you have received this advice at some point. Friends tend to dole it out when a loved one faces some major decision, whether to seek a divorce, take a job offer, buy a house, etc. This advice has served me pretty well, but not perfectly, and my attempts to follow it have raised several questions. What exactly does it mean to trust your gut? When is doing so a good or bad idea? How should we think about the relationship between gut-level insights and conscious deliberation? What role does trusting one's gut play in the exercise of practical wisdom? Tom Cochran's 2018, The Emotional Mind. A control theory of affective states provides a wealth of concepts and theories that could help explain the usefulness of, and the problems with, trusting your gut in decision-making. This essay will sidestep most of those resources, focusing on Cochran's concept of emotional bodily feelings. Cochran uses this concept to argue that the somatic aspects of emotions, a racing heart, a flushed face, tensed or relaxed muscles, etc., are a source of emotional meaning in their own right, page 89. Therefore, bringing these somatic feelings to conscious awareness is tantamount to achieving emotional self-awareness. In the context of Cochran's larger argument, acquiring emotional self-awareness is an incredibly valuable capacity. It paves the way for discernment of moral values, creative problem-solving, the navigation of competing personal interests and social norms, and rationality in general. If Cochran is correct, then we all have very good reasons to follow the advice, listen to your gut. If not the stronger advice, trust your gut. To lay the foundation of that argument, this essay pursues a much more modest goal. It relies on the emotional mind to show why listening to your gut is a reasonably good path to emotional self-awareness. Toward this end, the first half or so of the essay offers an analysis of what many people mean by the colloquial advice to trust your gut, at least when they deploy that advice in context of an ongoing dialogue about a friend or family member's major life decision. Then, this article summarizes, at a rather breakneck pace, Cochran's account of emotions and bodily emotional feelings. Then it briefly spells out how these concepts might be deployed to understand the advice to trust your gut, as nearly tantamount to saying, pursue emotional self-awareness. Exploring Cochran's larger argument about the function of emotions in rationality, morality, and social life is beyond the scope of this essay, although I suspect doing so could enrich an account of the utility of the advice, trust your gut. Section 1. Trusting your gut in common parlance. What do people mean when they tell each other to trust your gut? Much depends on the context in which the phrase is deployed. I have often heard women give each other this advice in anticipation that the advice receiver will face some situation requiring quick decision-making to protect her physical safety. For instance, throughout my adolescence, my mother urged me, "Pay attention when you feel uncomfortable around someone, especially a man, even when you can't quite put your finger on why you feel uncomfortable. Feel free to keep some distance from that person. Don't feel obliged to explain yourself. Trust your gut." She, and I suspect most of the people who tell others to trust your gut, meant, roughly, rely on your feelings for guidance, especially for help detecting subtle red flags about risks in your environment, especially when you need to make a fast call. These relied-on feelings might or might not include tangible bodily sensations like a quickened pulse or goosebumps. Rather, relied on feelings might entail a generalized sense of unease or alertness, a sense without any conscious physical expression. In this usage context, trust your gut can mean something almost entirely metaphorical, something equivalent to trust your intuitions, with little or no reference to physical sensations. I'd like to explore a different genre of trust your gut advice, deployed in the context of conversations about weighty, long-term decisions. In these contexts, trust your gut often does involve the suggestion that the advice receiver should pay attention to physical sensations. I suspect this genre of advice is an especially common element of advanced degree-holding American women's friendship, or among anyone in Breen Brown's 2022 listenership, though perhaps other groups dole out this advice to each other too. These conversations might go as follows. Friend number one. How are you feeling about some big decision? Friend number two. You know, there's a ton I don't know yet, but now that I've called it, I can just breathe easier. I feel steadier. Like my shoulders have relaxed for the first time in months. Friend number one. I'm so glad for you. Trust your gut, listen to your body. How are you sleeping? Friend number two. Never better. I sleep like a rock. Best sleep I've gotten in 2 years. I think it's the relief. In this usage of trust your gut advice, it seems that the instruction is meant to be taken at least semi-literally. Not entirely literally, mind you, since a quite literal paraphrase would be, do what the insides of your abdomen advise you. That seems too narrow, and not just because the digestive tract does not deliver step-by-step behavioral instructions. Another reason an entirely literal interpretation would be too narrow is that gut feelings often involve some non-abdominal part of the body. In this subset of trust your gut advice, the physical sensations are understood to contain a kind of wisdom. Guiding intuitions might present themselves as tension between the shoulder blades, lightness in one step, upright posture, dizziness, in addition to presenting as a knot, hollowness, flutter, etc., in the pit of one's stomach. Situations wherein the advice trust your gut means something like attend to your somatic experiences interest me because on the one hand, the emotional mind throws light on the possible value of this advice and on the other hand, this specific type of advice seems to be having a cultural moment. Glennon Doyle, 2023, 4:30-40:00, Prentice Hemphill, 2021, Midnight to 1:20, Breen Brown, 2023, 40:55-45:00, Harvard Business Review, Wilding 2022, and Forbes Magazine, Wilson 2018 have doled out some version of this advice. These culture generators seem to be reacting against a different strand of conventional wisdom, one which prioritizes rationality over emotion in decision-making. These sources not only reject the rationality/emotion hierarchy, they go one step further. They treat not just the conceptual aspects of emotional experience, the recognition, I am afraid that I will lose my job, but the bodily experience of emotions, my heart is about to pound out of my chest, as important sources of insight and wisdom. For figures like Breen Brown, Prentice Hemphill and Glennon Doyle, trust your gut entails something more than take an inventory of your body's physical reactions. Rather, it means something like, draw guidance from your body's physical reactions to inform your next steps. This raises the question of what kind of guidance a person is supposed to draw from their bodily sensations once they have brought those sensations to conscious awareness. For example, what exactly is a person to do with the information that they feel exhausted, have a growing pressure behind their eyes, and a leaden heaviness in their whole body every time they consider broaching the topic of couples therapy with their partner? I suspect those who advise others to trust your gut would say that the next thing to be done with that information is to translate a bodily sensation into a recognition of one's own emotions, presuming one has not already made that intuitive leap. In the foregoing example, it seems pretty clear that the headachy, tired person's body is expressing the emotion of dread at the possibility of couples therapy. So, in this case, trusting your gut seems to mean at least acknowledging one's dread. What else might trusting your gut in this sense entail? Does it require going a step further and actually avoiding the thing one's body clearly dreads, couples therapy in this case? Does trusting your gut mean complying with, deferring to, or obeying the emotions and motivations revealed to us after probing our bodily reactions? Not necessarily. Slogans like trust your gut admit a great deal of flexibility in their normal usage. There is a lot of wiggle room here. Furthermore, one of the most common reasons that one person would tell another to trust your gut is that the advice giver also finds the person's decision challenging. It's a way of not responding directly, of not giving concrete instructions that might later prove unsound. A person often admonishes another to trust your gut when the speaker really does not know what the other person should do. Thus, the very use of the phrase trust your gut should alert us to the possibility that the advice receiver is facing a decision riddled with ambiguity, and that the advice giver sees that ambiguity too. It is fairly easy to imagine why people would want to offer vague advice to loved ones. No one wants to be held responsible for the regret someone might feel after leaving a marriage, quitting a job, buying an overly expensive house, etc. I think we come closer to understanding how the advice trust your gut relates to decision-making if we juxtapose it with another frequent bit of instruction about the body's role in judgment. We can imagine an advice giver, in the same breath and without contradicting themselves, telling someone facing a weighty decision both trust your gut and don't make any knee-jerk decisions. These two pieces of advice point in the same direction in that they both direct a person to slow down, take a beat, and try to gain emotional self-awareness. Where these pieces of advice differ is the reason why a person needs emotional awareness. In the first case, the person is urged to seek information from the body in order to inform a decision. It seems to mean, pay attention to the information you know, but, for a variety of reasons, would really prefer not to know. Trust your gut means slow down and take your emotions into account, rather than capitulating to social pressure or some other exigency that makes your emotional experience rather inconvenient or costly to attend to at the moment. In the second case, a person is urged to seek information about their emotions in order to avoid uncritical impulsive bodily behavior, including verbal behavior. Don't make any knee-jerk decisions means something like slow down and make sure your not fully conscious emotions aren't unduly biasing and rushing your judgment. There's something here about grounding a decision maker's locus of control. Advice givers seem to be saying, find the middle path. Don't neglect the emotions conveyed by your body because you're paying too much attention to social norms and other important external realities, political, economic, cultural conditions, etc. But also don't neglect important social norms and other important external realities, political, economic, cultural conditions, etc., because you are overwhelmed by your embodied experience of your emotions. In sum, it seems to me that the advice to trust your gut is less about confidently carrying out the attitudes revealed by one's bodily conveyed emotional state than it is about making emotionally self-aware, intentional decisions. What remains to be explored is the value of this conventional wisdom. Can attending to somatic experiences actually lead to emotional self-awareness, to say nothing of intentional decision-making? So, why so? On this front, Tom Cochran's The Emotional Mind is helpful because it offers an account of how bodily feelings can convey emotional meaning. Section 2. Emotions and Emotional Bodily Feelings. In order to leverage Cochran's account of emotional bodily feelings, in explaining the utility of trust your gut advice, I first need to sketch Cochran's ontology of emotion. To quote him directly, an emotion is a valent representation of a situated concern. The specific character of the emotion relies on 1. The characteristics of the object, 2. The formal features predicated of that object, and 3. The characteristics of the response strategy. Cochran 2018, page 213. This definition, though precise, requires some unpacking. To condense a great deal of Cochran's argument, the human capacity to feel emotions is an evolutionary adaptation that promotes species survival, although not every instance of emotional experience promotes survival, as suicidal feelings of sadness make clear, Cochran 2018, pages 3-4, 12, 42, 66. Emotions serve this function by helping humans regulate their environments, Cochran 2018, pages 24-27. Emotions prompt humans to act in ways that effectively regulate situated concerns, like physical safety, nutrition, social connections, and a variety of concerns we learn to care about through socialization. Cochran 2018, pages 74, 83-88. Again, the actual concerns a human ends up emoting about may or may not promote their individual survival, but the underlying ability to identify a diverse range of concerns and to regulate environments in order to promote them is enormously helpful to humanity's survival as a species. Cochran 2018, pages 42, 67, 139, 188. Emotions help humans regulate our environment in two closely related ways. First, emotions are the phenomena by which a human nervous system represents to itself and the rest of its body an actionable account of its environment. Cochran 2018, pages 37. Our emotions provide a map of what matters, an organized synthesis of the nervous system's overwhelming mass of sensory experience. Emotional representations describe how our internal and external, real and imagined, environment is blocking/supporting or might block/support our regulation of situated concerns, of those things that matter to us, Cochran 2018, pages 67-9. Second, and regardless of our conscious awareness of our emotions, the nervous system's representations of environmental conditions trigger bodily responses that enable environmental regulatory behaviors, Cochrane 2018, pages 91 to 92. Hence, fear is constituted both by the nervous system's recognition of danger afoot, as well as the rest of the body's automatic and synchronized response to that danger. Increased heart rate, blood directed away from the digestive system and toward the limbs, contraction of the pupils, etc. Fear involves both the nervous system's representation of the environment and the bodily response to that representation. All emotions have both aspects: the nervous system's representation of the environment and a concordant physiological response. Cochrane 2018, pages 72-3. One helpful element of Cochrane's ontology of emotions is that it explains how it is possible to have an emotion without being aware of that emotion, without consciously feeling it. Cochrane 2018, pages 113. Emotion's evolutionary function is to help an organism regulate its environment by seamlessly orchestrating the organism's 1. Perception of and 2. Response to its environmental conditions. The nervous system can do this without a person's conscious awareness. Cochrane 2018, pages 92-93. Take the felicitous example of a person who is not aware that they are feeling particularly happy about their work life until a coworker points out that they have been cheerily humming all morning. Or the more difficult example of a person who only realizes how furious they are with a parent when they find themselves rehashing years-old slights and spitting bullets in psychotherapy. In both examples, Cochrane's account of emotions would suggest that each person's emotions have been operating the whole time to shape how the person copes with their environment, in more or less subtle ways, without the person being conscious of those emotions. If emotional self-awareness is important to us, and admittedly it might not be to everyone, this emotional ontology presents a practical problem. It suggests our emotions could slip beneath our radars, driving our behaviors in ways we might not understand or approve of. Attention to emotional bodily feelings constitutes one possible solution to that problem. Cochrane defines an emotional bodily feeling as the conceptualization of a bodily response aspect of an emotion. Cochrane 2018, pages 213. To paraphrase, a person has an emotional bodily feeling when they realize that something their body is doing, pulse racing, mouth turning up, eyebrows lifting, etc., is an expression and constitutive part of how they are interpreting and responding to something in their, real or imagined, environment. For example, if a person has received good medical results and immediately feels their jaw loosen and recognizes in that feeling an expression of profound relief, then they have had an emotional bodily feeling. What about subtler emotional experiences? The example cited above seems like one a person is unlikely to miss. But could attention to bodily feelings in general possibly yield insights into specifically emotional bodily feelings? Cochrane is aware that attentiveness to somatic experiences is not a perfect strategy for emotional self-awareness. Cochrane 2019, pages 107. It could produce false positives. I might confuse food poisoning for anxiety since both produce stomach churning. I might feel very, very sad when in fact I am mostly tired and just a little bit sad, personally. I try not to take very seriously any emotional reaction I have after 10 p.m. Or a person might misinterpret bodily feelings. Are these happy or overwhelmed tears? Still, paying attention to bodily feelings provides a good place to start asking questions about one's emotional condition. Attending to bodily feelings could help us stumble across our specifically emotional bodily feelings and the emotional meanings they contain. At this point, we are a long way down the road to explaining the utility of the colloquial advice to trust your gut. If Cochrane is correct that it is possible to have emotions we do not consciously feel and all emotions involve a bodily response, then pausing long enough to take a deep breath and do a body scan seems like an excellent route to uncover hidden emotions. Cochrane's account does not justify naive or complete trust in one's emotions, but that usage seems like a mismatch for the phrase's common meaning in any case. What Cochrane's account of emotions shows is that the emotions are fundamentally and unavoidably somatic phenomena. Therefore, paying attention to somatic experiences is an entirely reasonable path to emotional self-awareness. This insight is a modest one. It leaves open the question of why emotional self-awareness is valuable in the first place. The emotional mind throws a great deal of light on that larger question. For me as a character educator, the real payout of the emotional mind is its implications for the role emotional self-awareness could play in a person's moral self-regulation, i.e., in a person's attempts to live a life that reflects their deepest moral sentiments. Along the way to building that larger argument, the emotional mind adds some validity to common sense wisdom.
Article 7. Replies to Hatzimoisis. Sievers and Hilfendijk, Majid Gerrans and Whiting, by Tom Cochran. Thank you to Hatzimoisis, Hilfendijk and Sievers, Majid Gerrans, and Whiting for their generous and thoughtful comments on my book. It is now 5 years since the book was published, and several more since its main ideas were developed. I find it invigorating to be called once again to its defense. In some cases, forceful challenges have been raised. In other cases, lacunae are identified. But my overriding impression is that the commentators are sympathetic to the project and interested in seeing how it may tackle various problems that we encounter in the philosophy of mind. I want to emphasize that control theory is a broad framework for understanding the mind that, historically, we are only just beginning to explore. I believe it to be as powerful a framework for the mind as evolutionary theory is for biology. There is no doubt that, like evolutionary theory, there are many difficulties and complexities that need to be worked out, but the basic approach is incredibly fruitful. My book offers one way to develop a framework based on the limited considerations and evidence that I could muster. Researchers in disciplines like psychology, robotics, and sociology have been busily developing the approach in other ways. Indeed, I am keenly aware that I only deployed a general control theoretic approach to address long-standing issues in the philosophy of mind, while I am still ignorant of much of the specifics of control theory that have been developed by cognitive scientists. I think philosophers in particular would do well to think more about how control theory can help us make progress on foundational questions that we care about. Section 1. How immediate is the link between representation and response? The most foundational question that I address in the book is how brain activity gets to meaningfully refer to the world around us. My answer is valent representation, a kind of representation that triggers a response aimed at regulating the presence of its target. This negative feedback loop structure achieves a level of sensitivity that is characteristic of perception while also being mechanistically and evolutionarily plausible. But does the mind really work like that? Hatzimoisis' commentary most directly focuses on this issue, and I appreciate the clarity with which he presented the problem and the motivation for my solution. The main thrust of Hatzimoisis' worry is that, to the extent that my concept of valent representation is similar to Millikan's theory of pushmi-pullyu representations, it has limited applicability, making it unsuitable as a ground for mind. Both pushmi-pullyu representations and valent representations appeal to immediate connections between descriptive representations and directed responses, yet it seems that in most behavior, animals regularly and spontaneously engage in veracity testing, satisfaction testing, and directed denial with descriptive retention, Bauer 2020, none of which would be even conceivable if descriptive and directive content were not primarily given as clearly distinct, Hatzimoisis 2024, page 21. This issue. I suppose what I find conceivable differs from Hatzimoisis. First, I must note that detection and response are distinct in the valent representational loop. The detection of the target triggers a physically distinct response. It is because of this distinction that I can then allow for elaborations upon the basic valent representational schema, in which interferers from other systems inhibit the response. Indeed, the whole point of having a distinct detection node is to allow for interactions with other representational content, including multimodal content, in a way that seems to be lost in inactivist theories of the mind, Cochran 2018, pages 28 to 30. Yet, I suppose that the impulse to respond remains, ready to drive action as soon as inhibition is removed. In this way, delayed approach or avoidance responses can still get their meaning from regulative interactions. Second, I think Hatzimoisis may be right to argue that some of Millikan's examples, such as the bee's waggle dance, are not double-facing instances of unitary representation. Hatzimoisis 2024, page 21. The waggle dance example is most helpful for clarifying the idea that meaning is fixed by how other bees respond. The actual psychological mechanics involved in following a waggle dance or any other communicative signal are likely to be complex. Indeed, it is for this reason that I don't consider communicative uses of representation until quite late in my book. Third, it seems to me that some of our large-scale behavior shows a reflexive response to representation, such as the blink response and the nociceptive flexion reflex, sudden withdrawal from a source of heat. However, in complex animals like us, I take the primary instances of valent representation to be the homeostatic systems for regulating things like body heat, blood oxygen, or the expulsion of toxins. That is, our foundational valent representations are directed more at the internal milieu than the extrabodily environment. As far as I'm aware, there are good grounds to treat these systems as following negative feedback principles. Note that even our basic homeostatic systems are liable to layers of inhibition and elaboration. Take, for instance, the system for breathing. Breathing is subject to all sorts of refinement and control, ranging from babies instinctively holding their breath underwater, emotional modulations, talking and singing, all the way up to culturally inherited spiritual practices. Even so, the fact that we can inhibit or modulate our breathing up to a point does not at all imply that it isn't grounded in a basic regulated control loop, or that we don't possess a reflexive impetus to breathe when suffering oxygen starvation. On the contrary, if the link between detecting low blood oxygen and inhalation had to be learned or inferred somehow, we could expect it to be far less reliable. Thus, the control structure of our homeostatic systems is supposed to justify the idea that valent representation lies at the foundations of the mind. But why think that the same control structures are responsible for emotions, states that are more clearly intentional or meaningful in nature? Partly, it is due to the deep continuity we discern between emotional states and other affective states like pain, pleasure, nausea, itchiness, tiredness, and hunger. All of these states have a clear evaluative and survival function that align them with the homeostatic processes. The other big factor is that we frequently observe and introspectively discern the impulsive nature of our emotional responses. Of course, it is true that we inhibit and modulate our emotional responses. But it is no less true that we feel impulses that cry out for release. Even if we hold back our tears or our fists, we feel our hearts beating faster, the sweat springing to our brows, and the blush of the cheeks that demonstrate that organic nature prefers to prepare and hold back in readiness rather than initiate responses only once the checking is done. Section 2. Emotions versus bodily feelings. Hufvendieck and Severs do a great job of summarizing the key ideas of my theory of emotion. Although I'm glad to see that we agree on the major point that bodily responses play a necessary role in fixing emotional content, we disagree on the role of bodily experience and emotion. Recall that I define emotions as valent representations of situated concerns. They are systems for detecting certain kinds of qualities that trigger responses aimed at regulating those qualities. Bodily responses are thus a necessary part of these systems. But I claim that monitoring or conscious feeling of those responses are another layer of control and are not strictly necessary to emotion, even if they typically accompany them. One of my arguments for why the experience of bodily feelings is not necessary for a conscious emotional state is that there is non-bodily phenomenology, such as the sense of events slowing down or speeding up, Cochrane 2018, page 92. Hufvendieck and Severs suggest that this phenomenology could be caused by changes in heart rate or muscle tension, and even constituted by changes in blood pressure, hormone levels, etc., that we are unable to trace as such, but that still constitute the phenomenological core of emotions, Hufvendieck and Severs 2024, page 26. This issue. It seems to me a bit of an ad hoc defense to propose that this phenomenology is constituted by bodily feelings without our awareness. I think there are also alternate causal explanations for the sense of time slowing down or speeding up, for example, by how many cognitive events are occurring per second, or the extent to which we realize that our intentions are in conflict with what is happening, or the way that increased attention enhances perceptual contrasts. Hufvendieck and Severs later write that it is hard to see why somebody would want to introduce valent representation as a representation type whose function it is to regulate bodily responses, only then to draw an artificial distinction between the core representation of a situated concern and the representation of bodily responses, page 26. Of course, to me, the distinction is not at all artificial. When I first started thinking about emotions, I was persuaded by the Jamesian claim that without bodily feelings there would be no emotion. Yet the distinction between bodily feelings and emotions was forced on me by the consideration that bodily responses can be triggered without our awareness, Cochrane 2018, pages 90 to 93. that significant cognitive work is required to appropriately trigger those bodily responses. Pages 70 to 71. That particular object are part of emotional meaning, yet not captured by bodily feelings. Page 93. And that we are perfectly capable of attending separately to our bodily responses and the situation that. These responses are directed at pages 7 to 8. Not only this, but making a distinction between the initial emotion and the monitoring of bodily responses was extremely fruitful in helping to grasp the additional function of coping potential, section 4.7, the nature of moods, section 4.3, refinements and emotion types, page 110, the distinct sense of confidence, page 111, and our capacities for empathy, ch 5. I also consider it a genuine reconciliation between cognitivist and non-cognitivist positions on emotional experience that has persisted for more than a century. When a debate persists for so long, I think we must find ways to explain how both sides have grasped a piece of the truth. Section 3. Social Norms. Hufendieck and Severs go on to provide an interesting review of the ways in which our emotions are influenced by social norms. Relevant to later points I will address about emotional modularity, Hufendieck and Severs point out that non-human animals show differential emotional responses in social settings. Our expressive behavior is also sensitive to social hierarchy. I entirely endorse our argument that for social animals, the triggered responses may be harnessed for social purposes and may therefore be subject to social influences, such as socially normative regularities, Hufendieck and Severs 2024, page 27. This includes a claim that we become ontogenetically attuned to social norms in a way that shapes our bodily response patterns and the representational content, page 27. It is not the case that, in my view, social norms are merely about self-consciously holding ourselves to certain ideals of propriety, a point I make in passing in Chapter 6. Chapter 5 of my book is devoted to analyzing how social interactions constitute a distinct level in control hierarchy of valent representation, one that is developmentally and evolutionarily prior to our conscious reasoning capacities. This control function is achieved by means of our expressive behavior. And the purpose of expressive behavior is not merely to conform to social rules about what situations merit what emotions, but to regulate our affiliative status, our levels of intimacy and dominance with respect to other animals. The consequence is that I allow for social versions of emotions like fear and anger, Cochrane 2018, page 122. Thus, following one of Hufendieck and Severs' examples, one could experience a distinctly social fear, the regulative aim of which is to protect the group from harm. Another aspect of my account worth emphasizing is that I do not think the affiliated control function can be entirely reduced to the individual animal's neurobiological machinery, since this mechanism relies indispensably on how others react, section 5.4, section 5.5. Given the reliance of the system on how others in fact react, my view entails that culturally specific patterns of emotional interaction can emerge. I do not claim that there are entire types of emotion that are culturally specific, where, say, the individuals in one culture feel a wumbuck, page 207, while the individuals in another culture never do, even if the second culture lacks a term for that emotion. The components out of which our emotions are made and the mechanisms whereby intimacy and dominance are established are species-wide. Yet styles of effective interaction can vary between cultures, or indeed between small groups, such that one group has a flamboyant manner of social-emotional regulation, where another is mutually restrained, or where one group embraces exquisite refinements in social hierarchy, where another group is rigorously egalitarian. Of course, it is also possible for the way we understand situations to differ, such that some people find a situation worthy of anger, where other people find it worthy of sadness. Allowing for such variations is an indispensable feature of any plausible emotion theory. Section 4. Natural Kinds. This brings me to Majid's 2024, this issue, commentary. Majid wonders if, given their wide variability and flexibility, the affective states form an innate natural kind. In particular, he is skeptical that grief involves the same sort of causal mechanism as other emotions, which, according to Griffiths, 1997, is a condition of belonging to a common natural kind. In section 7.5, I characterize grief as a product of loving sentiment. Note that I do not say that it is a sentiment. Sentiments are concerns directed at specific individuals enduring through time that we track as doing well or badly in their own right. Cochrane, 2018, page 171 to 172. This sort of concern is underwritten by our capacity for generating narratives about these individuals. Page 175 to 177. It is the idea that different kinds of affective states are unlocked by innovations in representational sophistication that leads me to describe hierarchical levels of valent representation. Page 196. Given the distinctive and generalizable nature of human sentiments, I think they count as a natural kind. And since sentiments function according to the basic causal principles of valent representation, we have impulsive responses to regulate how well or badly the targets of our sentiments are doing. They also belong to the wider natural kind of affective states. The situation is a bit more complex for grief. I argue that the shifting emotional responses we see over the course of the grieving process are the product of the kind of long-term adaptation I described earlier with regards to the shaping of personality. Page 174. Majid does not quote the last part of this sentence when he discusses my position, but it is crucial for avoiding his charge that I have asserted without justification that grief is an evolutionary adaptation. Earlier in that chapter, I talk about how personality develops over the course of a person's life as they adapt to the opportunities and skills available to them. Page 165. My claim is that a similar sort of gradual adaptation is occurring in grief. To clarify, the emotions of grief attempt to restore or compensate for a major loss that cannot be restored or compensated. The griever adopts several different emotional strategies, such as bargaining, anger, and sadness, until they eventually adjust their expectations about the status of the beloved, which stops their emotions being triggered so frequently. Does this make grief a natural kind? I think there is a definite mechanism here in which one's sentiment towards a beloved is reprogrammed. Yet, since the process will involve a great deal of conscious reevaluation, I would expect it to be highly variable between individuals. If that level of variability is compatible with calling it a natural kind, then that's fine by me. Meanwhile, the emotions we experience in grief are again all valent representations, even if they are characteristically unsuccessful, which is why we can broadly incorporate grief into the category of affective states. Section 5. Neurobiological variability. Majid's commentary then moves on to whether claims about emotional innateness can be maintained in the face of the evidence of neurobiological variability between people's emotions. Majid is right to point out that the layers of elaboration that I propose upon valent representation give me the resources to allow for a wide range of variability. Specifically, these resources include calculations of coping potential via the monitoring of our bodily responses, expressive signaling and coordination, conscious checking and planning processes, adherence to social norms, sentimental attachments, as well as variable personality strategies. The range of complex affective phenomena that I can capture in this manner is far beyond a simplistic idea of blending basic emotions. Despite these elaborations, I still claim that at the base of the mind, we possess categorically distinct systems of valent representation that are innately tuned to a limited range of stimuli. I also think there are definite systems for detecting losses, gains, obstacles, and other formal qualities characteristic of the emotion types, which trigger responses aimed at regulating those sorts of situations. I only describe these systems as somewhat modular, because I do not believe them to be informationally encapsulated. Majid notes how I allow for our emotional systems to be attuned to new stimuli. We start with a certain range of what counts as an attractant or avoidant, which gets broadened by both associative, Cochrane 2018, page 82 to 85, and inferential processes, page 142 to 145. I also suppose that thresholds for stimulation can be adjusted in the process of personality development, page 165. Majid observes, however, that I am less flexible with regards to the output responses of our unelaborated emotions. A major reason for positing innate systems of emotional response is just our common observations of stereotypical emotional impulses. Despite how often they're inappropriate for dealing with the situations faced by civilized humans, e.g., raging at a slowly loading computer, But are our responses really so stereotypical? Majid cites Barrett's work on emotional variability. Majid, 2022, Section 1, has also argued that we should take this empirical data at face value. I do not follow him here. When I looked into this data, my impression was that it was extremely messy, confounded by researchers' differing concepts of emotional stimuli, which I discuss in Cochrane 2018, page 86 to 87. In particular, I'd expect calculations of coping potential and social affiliations to result in major differences to our physiological and behavioral responses, and a fortiori to our neurological activity, to a point where different emotion categories are justifiable, as noted in Section 3 above, as well as my praise C. As such, it is imperative that these factors are controlled for when collecting data about emotion variability. Meanwhile, Majid's 2022 paper outlines a way in which a person's emotional reactions could gradually take on modular characteristics, making them interpersonally stereotypical while interpersonally variable. This view can thereby undercut inferences from stereotypical processes to innate modules. Majid argues that the systems we are born with are domain-relevant rather than domain-specific, meaning that they are only biased towards the processing of certain sorts of information rather than dedicated to them. Such biases, in turn, can lead to the gradual development of brain circuits progressively selected to process inputs of that kind. Section 3.2. This is an interesting proposal, though I'd like more detail on how a system tracks what counts as domain relevant. To my mind, having a few innate concerns and responses that can then be elaborated is more mechanistically plausible than an initially ambiguous set of concerns and responses. Moreover, I want to note again that my categorical emotion systems are refinements of our fundamental homeostatic processes, which, as far as I'm aware, involve innately specified inputs and outputs. The way that my approach aligns our overall mental economy with these basic biological processes gives it the important theoretical virtue of scope. Section 6. Pain asymbolia. Gerrans also denies that emotions are natural psychological kinds when they say that there is no specialized system whose role is to transform feelings of bodily arousal to feelings of danger. Gerrans 2024, page 38, this issue. However, Gerrans is referring to our experiences of the emotional bodily responses here. I only make nativist categorical claims about our simplest emotional systems, which I sharply distinguish from the experience of emotional bodily responses. It was because I recognized that the experiences of our bodily responses do not intrinsically present emotional meaning, as Gerrans notes, that I added a condition that their categorical distinctions are due to socially influenced conceptualization, Section 4.6. As such, I am not at all committed to there being specialized neural systems for imposing categorical meanings onto feelings. I am, however, committed to specialized neural systems for detecting that, say, something of value has been lost. I suppose these detections to be achieved by contrast representations, e.g., good before, bad now, that use structural features of cognition to capture content in a non-linguistic way available to non-human animals, page 73 to 75. I think these contrast representations are innate because I do not see how they can be learned. Meanwhile, Gerrans has much more to say about pain asymbolia, a condition in which individuals are aware of pain, but seem not to experience it with suffering and do not display the usual aversive responses. As Gerrans notes, I infer from pain asymbolia that pain has distinct sensory and affective components, and that pain asymbolia involved a loss of effect. However, Gerrans argues that even if individuals with pain asymbolia lack effect, this cannot explain their lack of aversive responses, since individuals with frontal lobotomy maintain exaggerated aversive responses to noxious stimuli with reduced or absent effect. In addition, pain asymbolia is most associated with damage to the posterior insular, yet this neural structure seems to be a hub for integrating bodily self-representations. Gerrans thus proposes that pain asymbolia is caused by an incapacity to track the self-relevance of pain, which has a downstream effect of eliminating suffering, a function more closely associated with the anterior insular, which serves as a hub for coordinating bodily self-awareness with our various adaptive responses. There's a lot that I like about Gerrans' account of pain asymbolia. Elsewhere in the book, Cochrane 2018, page 182, note 1, I also endorsed Jaren's 2015 account of depersonalization as a result of losing capacity to integrate a sense of self from the monitoring of our bodily responses. I also appreciate Jaren's attempt to allow that my general theory of emotional bodily feelings has the resources to accommodate pain as embolia, and of course it's great that he is also working within a broadly control theoretic framework. I need to make a couple of clarifications about my view of effect, however. First, I identify effect with neither emotions nor the feeling of emotional bodily responses, but only with the sense of intrinsic unpleasantness or pleasantness. This is not how the frontal lobotomy studies use the term effect, which for them refers to emotion more generally. Second, I do not directly associate unpleasant effect with our aversive bodily responses, unlike imperativist account of pain. I claim, rather, that effect is an urgency signal, the main function of which is to draw attention to and thereby prioritize existing aversive responses, Cochrane 2018, page 62. Thus, lack of effect, in my sense, is compatible with the presence or absence of emotional responses. I can even allow that reflexive withdrawal responses may be intensified if emotions are lost, since it is a general feature of my account that higher-level valent representations can inhibit lower-level valent representations, e.g., page 187. As far as I'm concerned, I only needed the case of pain as embolia to demonstrate the distinction between the sensory representation of bodily damage and intrinsic unpleasantness, which it still does. If as embolia is more directly explained by the loss of self-representations than effect per se, then I think I could endorse this. Note that in my view, unpleasant affect is a higher level representation that combines a representation of one's response with a representation of the target, in this case, bodily damage. One represents oneself as failing to regulate and avoidant. Thus, the incapacity to monitor one's responses to bodily damage would have a downstream effect of eliminating unpleasant effect from bodily damage. I would like to sound a note of caution, however. It seems that while pain asymbolic individuals lack the fear of bodily harm, they retain other emotions. For instance, in one account, the pain asymbolic individual became angry when called a liar and a thief, Klein 2015, page 501. Given that emotions like anger are intact, the monitoring of their emotional bodily responses, and therefore general capacity for bodily self-representation, may remain intact as well. Thus, account of pain asymbolia need to stay focused on problems with emotion and self-representation particularly linked to bodily harm. Finally, it is tricky to draw robust conclusions about pain asymbolia because we have so few detailed reports of these individuals' experiences. Hopefully, future reports will check if they can experience intrinsic unpleasantness in other sorts of ways, e.g., due to failure of a project, and whether their attention is still grabbed by bodily damage even if they don't suffer it, which would seriously undermine my model of effect. Section 7. Trusting Your Gut. Finally, I turn to Whiting's 2024, this issue, commentary, which is focused on the epistemology of our emotions. Whiting is particularly interested in our emotional self-awareness and how this may feed into our rational decision-making. Certainly, it is part of my view that the awareness of our emotional bodily responses is a guide to our emotional state. These bodily responses carry information about how we have appraised a situation that we might not have consciously realized. Refer to Cochrane 2018. Page 96, where I describe this as one sort of mood. At the same time, I do not think that trusting your gut is good generalizable advice, as Whiting seems to agree. Specifically, one's emotional bodily feelings are just one source of information that can feed into a complex decision-making process. Related to this, Michael Brady's 2013 book is an excellent discussion of the extent to which one can trust one's emotional reactions, and in my book, I approvingly quote his view that emotional experience is best treated as a stimulus to try and further understand the cause and basis of one's emotion, Cochrane 2018, page 142. What is perhaps more distinctive to me is the view that because rational thinking is a motivated process, it is itself an elaboration of affective processing. Even the rational regulation of one's emotions can be understood as a meta-emotional state. This raises interesting issues about whether it is always rational to regulate one's emotions, which I pick up in a later article, Cochrane 2021. If one does not particularly want to be a hyper-rational person, because, for instance, it tend to undermine one's exuberance, then it will be irrational to continually wonder if one's emotion is rational. Doing so would effectively be worrying about something that you don't care about, thus irrational in the sense that it is not emotionally true that something has occurred that threatens your concerns. Thus, epistemic and not just prudential, rationality can depend on one's larger concerns about life. Related to this, Whiting makes a nice point that in a social situation, advising someone to trust their gut may be a way to avoid giving specific advice that makes us partially responsible for a disastrous decision. We want the other person to make some kind of authentic emotional decision by their own lights. So, I think the most important issue here is how we discern what our most authentic attitudes are. In Chapter 7, Cochrane 2018, I introduce character as a final boss level of the effective life. This is a level at which we most explicitly decide what really matters to us and the kind of person we want to be. As I see it, our character commitments are most clearly settled by what we love, and the way that our loves can demand that we regulate our emotions and even our rational thinking processes. In particular, in Section 7.7, I describe how character commitments dictate our tendencies to consciously reflect on situations, engage in long-term planning, and the extent to which we ought to adhere to social normative standards. Overall, in keeping with the overall hierarchical organization of the mind that I have outlined in the book, I do not think that the most authentic emotional state is one that is hidden deep inside one's gut, and it therefore has to be brought into the light. The authentic emotional life is rather the highest level of elaboration that we achieve as our various levels of regulated control contribute to large-scale determinations about how we want to live.
This marks the end of the 2024, Volume 5, Issue 2, Winter Podcast Edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please join us again for our next podcast edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion.